Penguin Random House Audio presents Northern Spy by Flynn Berry. Read for you by Catherine Lee McEwen. For Ronan and Declan. They will forget about you. We won't. IRA Graffiti, 2019. Part 1. Chapter 1. We are born with a startle reflex. Apparently it's caused by the sensation of falling. Sometimes, in his crib, my son will fling out his arms, and I hold my hand to his chest to reassure him. It happens less often now than in the first months. He doesn't constantly think the ground is falling away beneath him. I do, though. My startle reflex has never been so strong. Of course it is. Everyone's is at the moment. That's part of living in Northern Ireland, at this point in time, during this phase of terrorism. It's difficult to know how scared to be. The threat level is severe, but then it has been for years. The government evaluates terrorist organisations based on capacity, timescale, and intent. At the moment, we should be worried about the IRA on all three counts. An attack might be imminent, but no one can say where. The odds are not here, not on this lane where I'm walking with the baby. A gunman isn't about to appear around the bend in the road. I always watch for one in Belfast on my way to work, but not out here, surrounded by hedgerows and potato fields. We live, for all intents and purposes, in the middle of nowhere. My house is on the Ards Peninsula, a curve of land between Strangford Loch, a deep saltwater inlet, and the sea. Grey Abbey is a tiny village, a twist on the Loch Road. 400 houses set among green fields and lanes and orchards. On the Loch shore, canoes float in the reeds. This doesn't look like a conflict zone. It looks like the place you'd return to after a war. Finn sits in his carrier on my chest, facing forward down the lane. I chat to him, and he babbles back at me, kicking his heels against my thighs. Ahead of us, birds disappear into gaps in the hedgerow. At the edge of the pasture, a row of telephone poles rises along the road. Past them, the sky is white toward the sea. My son is 6 months old. The conflict might be over by the time he can walk or read. It might end before he learns to clap, or says his first word, or drinks from a cup, or has whole fruit instead of puree. All of this might never touch him. It should already be over, of course. My sister and I were born near the end of the Troubles. We were children in 1998, when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. We painted peace signs and doves on bedsheets and hung them from our windows. It was all meant to be finished then. Except bodies were still being found in peat bogs along the border. Searches were being conducted to find informers the IRA had disappeared. The coroner's inquests hadn't all finished, or the investigations into police collusion, and riots still broke out every year during marching season. At certain funerals, men in ski masks and mirrored sunglasses would appear in the cortege, chamber their handguns, and fire shots over the coffin, which was odd, since they said they'd decommissioned all their weapons. So, it was never peace exactly. The basic argument of the Troubles hadn't been resolved. Most Catholics still wanted a united Ireland. Most Protestants wanted to remain part of the UK. The schools were still segregated. You still knew, in every town, which was the Catholic bakery, which was the Protestant taxi firm. How could anyone not have seen this coming? We were living in a tinderbox. Of course it was going to catch, and when it did, so many men were ready to throw themselves back into the fighting. Peace hadn't suited them. They hadn't made a success of it. In their statements and communiques, I could sense their relief, like they were sleeper agents left behind in an enemy country, glad that they hadn't been forgotten. From the lane, I turn onto the Lock Road. The water is platinum with sunlight. It will be hot again today. I want this walk to last, but soon we're at the main street and his daycare. I kiss Finn goodbye, confident, as always, that between now and tomorrow morning, I'll find the trick that will let me spend the day both at work and with him. My phone rings as I near the bus stop. "Have you heard from Marion today?" my mother asks. "No, why?" "There's supposed to be a thunderstorm." Marion has gone to the North Coast for a few days. She is staying in a rented cottage on a headland near Ballycastle. "She's not diving, is she?" "No," I say, not mentioning what Marion had told me about wanting to swim into the caves at Ballantoy if she could time it right with the tides. I hoped she would. I liked the thought of her swimming through the limestone arches, bobbing in the water inside the mouth of the caves. It would be like an antidote, the quiet and the spaciousness, the exact opposite of Belfast, of her work as a paramedic, sitting in the back of an ambulance, racing through red lights, steeling herself for the moment when the doors will open.
"There's no sense in doing that on your own."
"She's not diving, ma'am. See you tonight, okay?" On Thursdays, when we broadcast our programme, my mother collects Finn from daycare, since I don't get home in time. It means a long day for her. She works as a housekeeper for a couple in Bangor. She cleans her house, buys their food, washes their clothes. They keep the thermostat so high all year that she works in a pair of shorts and a tank top. Twice a week, she puts on a coat to drag their bins down the long gravel drive and back up again. They recently spent £500,000 to put a heated, single-lane swimming pool under their house, which neither of us can believe she has never used.
"Not even when they're away?" asked Marion.
Our mom laughed. "Catch yourself on." Chapter 2. On the bus into the city, I look through my reflection at the lock. Across its vast surface, the faint shapes of the Mourne Mountains rise in the distance. I send Marion a message, then scroll up to the picture she sent me yesterday of herself standing on the Carrickarede Rope Bridge. Tourists used to wait for hours to cross the bridge, but now it hangs empty for most of the year, the waves crashing 100 feet beneath it. In the picture, she is alone, her hands gripping the ropes, laughing. Marion has wavy brown hair that she wears loose or piled on top of her head with a gold clasp. We look similar, same eyes and cheekbones and dark hair, though Marion's is an inch shorter than mine and softer. Her natural expression, when she's not speaking, is open and amused, like she's waiting to hear the end of a joke, while mine tends to be more grave. Both have their drawbacks. I often have to reassure people that I'm not worried when I am, in fact, thinking, and Marion, who has been a paramedic for 6 years, still gets asked on every shift if she's new to the job. She will say, "I'm going to insert an IV line now," and the patient will look alarmed and say, "Have you done that before?" Neither of us looks like our mother, who is blonde and sturdy, with an air of brisk warmth. We look like our father and his side of the family, his sisters and parents, which seems unfair given that we never see him, or any of them. I allow myself to daydream until the road separates from the lock, then open my phone to start reading the news. I produce a weekly political radio programme at the BBC. Some of the broadcasts devolve into local politicians shouting over each other, but others turn electric, especially now. You can't live in Northern Ireland at the moment and not be interested in politics. When we reach Belfast, I stop at Dean's for a flat white. Everything about the
sample complete. Ready to continue?